Greetings, Earthlings. Welcome to episode 8 of Spellbound. I'm Julian Smith, getting close to that 10-episode mark. Special thanks to the lovely folks over at Audible for supporting today's episode. They're giving our listeners a free audiobook and a free 30-day trial. You can get it by going to audible.com/spellbound or by texting spellbound to 500-500. Today, we're talking to New York Times best-selling author, the one and only Peggy Orenstein. Peggy, thanks for joining us. I'm a huge fan of your work. I love the way you write. It's a huge honor to be talking to you today, so thanks for making the time.
Aw, thanks. That's really nice of you.
And now I'll bore you with a few details about yourself for the sake of my listeners. You are the New York Times best-selling author of Girls and Sex, Cinderella Ate My Daughter, Waiting for Daisy, and a bunch of other awesome books. You're also a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and have been published in USA Today, Parenting, Salon, and The New Yorker. You've got a new book out, Don't Call Me Princess, which I've been thoroughly enjoying, and I feel honored to be reading it before it's even out. My wife was making fun of me the other day because I was reading it in the bathtub, and it's bright pink. I think the only thing missing was a couple of candles.
I know. Here I am like the biggest critiquer of the color pink, and yet it has become my brand. It's the biggest irony of my career.
I think it's great. I think it goes along with the whole point you're making, and I love it. I love everything you're doing.
Well, thank you.
Especially because I have two daughters.
Aww.
And I want them to grow up in a world where they're going to get a fair chance. And this is a conversation I think is totally important.
Yeah.
So let's just dive right in. In your new book, Don't Call Me Princess, you talk a lot about, in the beginning, you talk a lot about your early career working for Miss Magazine in the 80s, which was the first feminist publication, if I'm not mistaken.
I think so. Yeah. At least the first main. Well, I don't know if that's fair. It's certainly the first mainstream commercial,
right?
Feminist publication. There, you know, there probably were like the mimeographed. I don't know. I'm too old. I'm too young for that. Okay.
Miss Magazine was it was quite an uphill battle. It sounds like from your recounting of the story.
Yeah, it's really. I think it's a really interesting thing to reflect on now when. You know, obviously, the industry and where we get our news and how we get our news and all of that has changed so dramatically in the past decade or so. To look at the forces that shaped the magazine and, you know, newspaper industries and such from before all of that, I think is really instructive. I mean, I think people maybe weren't aware of the impact of corporations and advertising and all of that in really shaping editorial content and what we read. So there's some ways that I think the internet has been really liberating and allowed a lot of different kinds of voices and points of view out, even as we've become embroiled in the whole, you know, everybody being balkanized and fake news and influences from Russia and all of that kind of thing.
Yeah, and manipulated news. I mean, stuff that's like kind of true, but out of context and stuff.
So there's part of me that, you know, as somebody who is part of what we now, I guess, call the legacy media, but part of media that I think of as having accountability, even though, yes, there are times when mainstream media too, you know, blows it or really has something that's wrong or whatever, but there's some sense of accountability and process and often there's not on the internet, but at the same time, there are areas like I think that the whole discussion of sexual assault on campus, I think it would be very hard to have had that and had it had the impact that it did without the internet. You know, I think that allowed those voices to get out there in a way that mainstream media had not been willing to do and was not interested in until it became such a public thing on the internet that they couldn't ignore it anymore.
Yeah, and here's hoping that it stays that way with the internet.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, right. But it is really interesting. So looking at Ms. and looking at the battles that they had over trying to start a magazine and what they were and weren't allowed to have on the cover and the difficulty in advertising and what you do when you advertise for product. I mean, one of the funny things in that is about how they say that it looked like it was a magazine for fast-driving cross addicts for a while because the only advertising they could get was cars, liquor, and cigarettes because, you know, they couldn't have makeup, they couldn't have fashion. It was really interesting and sort of I hadn't read a lot of these pieces, and that one in particular, for a very long time. So to look back at that and think about how we imagined that and how we thought about those things at the time, and the impact now is, I think, interesting, not only from the perspective of feminism or girls and women's lives, but actually from our media lives as well.
Can you talk a little bit about Miss Magazine? It's such an interesting story that you tell in the book about the challenges that this progressive, controversial magazine faced. You guys had trouble keeping advertisers and fighting the public image of feminism at the time and all that stuff. It was really interesting to hear that. Could you tell people about your experience with that?
Well, so I was there and I was working for one of the editors at the magazine who was doing an anthology of writings on the status of women around the world. And I was helping research the introductions that gave all the information about women in all these different countries. But I was in the office, so I was observing and watching. And it was just, you know, I think working with those editors, and I mean, I think all the time about sort of having been in the peanut gallery of witnessing history, you know, people walking through the room, whether it was Gloria Steinem or Andrea Dworkin or, you know, Alice Walker was there at one point, various people that now feel like these iconic and sort of faraway figures, to have watched them when I was 19 years old or 20 years old, whatever I was pretty amazing. And I knew I wanted to be a writer, and that experience really, especially diving deep into the research on women around the world, just really, I guess, galvanized my interest even further in writing and thinking about women, though I immediately didn't do that when I graduated college. But, you know, that was the hope.
Do you think all this research and fact-checking you were doing at Miss Magazine maybe inspired you in some way to be on the path you still find yourself on today?
I'd like to say that's true, but, you know, I don't really remember what I was fact-checking back then. It was more just all the reading I was doing. You know, one of the things that was really, that I think we have lost in today's world, is that I was living in New York. I was there for a semester, so I wasn't embedded in any kind of, you know, group or friends, or, I mean, I really was alone. I was living with my older brother, but he had a girlfriend and he was never around. And it was too expensive to talk to people on the phone back then, long distance.
Right.
There was no internet. I didn't own a television. I don't think I even owned a radio. And so all I did was read and write in my spare time. So I would just sit there and read. You know, I had nothing else to do with my time. So I would just sit and read and read and read and read and read. And since I was working in this feminist context, I was reading all of these books to kind of give myself, you know, to get myself up to speed and educate myself. And I think that really was what did it. And when I look back, you know, I would write these, I had notebooks and notebooks and notebooks, because, again, I had nothing to do. So I would just sit in the cafe around the corner from me and, you know, drink 10 cups of coffee and write and just write everything that was in my head and everything that was happening around me. And I just think that was a really, that isolation and that kind of loneliness and disconnection allowed for a kind of intellectual exploration and lack of distraction that I think is very hard to come by right now.
Yeah, and it probably gave you a fresh perspective on everything.
I remember also how bleak it could feel to be that alone in a big city. But even things like, I remember deciding that I was going to read everything by Colette. And I just did, you know, because what did you have except for time when you were 20 years old and in a city and kind of doing an internship and having no friends? I wasn't going to sit and email. I wasn't going to be texting. I wasn't going to be FaceTiming. None of those things existed. So I just would read.
Yeah, don't even get me started on how many distractions there are today, because we'll have a totally different conversation.
Right? I know. I mean, I find it so hard now. I know it is a different conversation, but to just turn the world off enough to even write, you know, an article takes just enormous mental effort and willpower. And I do, you know, feel I don't have the discipline to, you know, or I guess it feels like one couldn't just refuse to engage in this stuff. But I think that it has come at a, it has some great benefits and also some really big costs.
Absolutely. Well, there's a yin and yang to everything, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure which I think are, you know, if I think it's an equal trade-off, but, you know.
Yeah,
that's a different conversation.
Totally. Yeah, I struggle with that same thought. You know, on one hand, I'm like, well, we should all just be living out in nature. And, you know, mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, it's like, well, no, technology has literally given everybody better lives. So it's, you know, it's definitely hard to say.
Or has it?
Dun, dun, dun. My oldest daughter, the other day we were outside playing together and, we were looking at like flowers really close up and stuff. And she was like, Daddy, why don't people live in nature? And I was just like dumbfounded. I was like, oh my God, this is a critical moment right here. So I was like, well, people used to live with nature and now we don't. And I think that's a great question. We had a little evolution lesson and it was really interesting that she was able to see that. You know, she recognized every other animal is out here. Why are we in these houses? You know,
right.
Kind of interesting. There's a recurring theme in your new book, one that suggests that new ideas, especially those that don't present a black and white argument, aren't welcomed into the mainstream. For instance, you juxtapose the struggles of the of Ms. Magazine with the financial abundance of the more vanilla mainstream publications like Vanity Fair and Time. Mm-hmm. Why do you think the masses are so opposed to new ideas?
From this perspective,
I mean, that's a big question, obviously. But from what has your experience been with this conversation?
Well, you know, I think for me, what interests me is a lot of exploring contradictions and gray areas, particularly in this evolving world and this evolving experience of what it means to be female. And I think, you know, in the sense that we are interested in new ideas, I mean, I think what it means to be female in our culture during our lifetimes has changed unbelievably dramatically. You know, I mean, you were talking about, you know, evolution a minute ago, but, you know, the evolution of women's place and role since, you know, in the last 50 years has been extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And for me, as somebody born or who grew up while that was sort of, while that second wave was happening, I was I remember calling myself a women's liber when I was actually, I didn't call myself that. I remember somebody making fun of me calling me that when I was 12. And that was when that was sort of going on. And one of the things I talk about in the Ms. article, that the frame of that article for me was very much about my own evolution as a girl and as a feminist and coming of age and recognizing when I was 12, going to a friend's house and seeing Ms. Magazine for the first time, because my mom would never have subscribed to that, but my friend's mom did, and it had Wonder Woman comics, and it had this amazing influence on us where we, you know, her mom, actually this may be sort of a warning, a cautionary tale about not having a parent at home, but we tied little towels around our necks and got up on the garage roof and started jumping back and forth between the garage roof and the next door neighbor's garage roof, which was just about a little bit longer than our stride. You know, it was dangerous for sure. But, you know, if we slipped, we would have died.
Right.
But, you know, that's what kids used to do. And we jumped back and forth with our towels streaming, yelling, Wonder Woman, Wonder Woman. And it was this sort of, you know, sense of liberation and freedom that was, to me, sort of the first moment of what feminism meant to me and where I started. And then I kind of track my own ambivalence and embracing and rejecting through that and through the story of Ms. and through the story of the media at the time. So it's that kind of blending both of the personal and what's going on in the world and also of sometimes the complexity of it. So even talking in that piece about being in college and feeling like, well, do we really want to use... This is actually interesting to me because I was walking... I'm bouncing around a little bit, but I was walking I was in a college town in the Midwest the other day, and I walked by Urban Outfitters, and there was a giant pillow, like the kind that you'd put on your dorm bed or your sofa or something, in the window, and it said feminist, 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 feminist on it. And I thought, wow. First of all, I don't think that would have been there 3 years ago.
Yeah, what year was this?
And this was just last week.
Wow.
And secondly, when I was in college, I really, despite, you know, talking about my internship and all of that at Ms., I really struggled over whether, you know, to take on that label of feminist, because it had these connotations of being man-hating and, mm-hmm. you know, being radical and all of this. So sort of going through that, the complications and nuance of my own evolution on this was as important to me as how Ms. went through it all. And I feel like that's sort of throughout the book, a really, and I guess throughout my work, a really important thing to me to be sort of reflecting back and forth between the subject I'm looking at and my own relationship to that subject.
It's been interesting for me reading your book because I was born in the 80s. So sorry to make you feel old, but I was unaware of some of these, you know, obviously I knew that women have been oppressed, you know, that's no secret.
Yeah.
But reading about some of your experiences, especially the ones earlier on in your career, it was just really eye-opening to me. And I still haven't finished the book, but I plan to. And it's just been really fascinating and eye-opening reading it for someone my age who's heard about these things, but has not really, read actual accounts from women who have been through the struggle themselves.
Okay, so now I do feel old. but, you know, it's funny because I feel like I certainly grew up in a post-feminist era. I mean, that's what we thought of ourselves as being post-feminist. That was the word then. And so...
Clearly, it's not post-feminist because Urban Outfitters has a pillow saying feminist, feminist, feminist.
I know. But we saw ourselves, I mean, we used to kind of joke, the joke was we were ladies of the 80s, you know, that was our kind of ironic little thing we would say. But, you know, what I talk about, the thing that I talk about in the beginning that really galvanized me as a writer was even before that, when I was in high school and my high school counselor asked me to do a story on teenage mothers in my high school, which was not a thing I knew was in my high school. I went to a huge high school, and I ended up interviewing this girl and not using her name, and it was a really that was a really profound experience for me to talk to this girl who had this 2-year-old and she was 17 years old.
Right.
And, you know, all of this. And then she walked out of the room and she stopped before she walked out of the room. And she said, if you see me in the hallway, don't say hello, because there's no way that somebody like you would know somebody like me. And I don't want anybody to get suspicious.
Wow.
And it just hit me. You know, I just thought, because of course I would have said hello to her in the hallway, you know?
Well, yeah, after something like that.
But it was that there was so much more than just like some, you know, tale about the teen, you know, the perils of teen sex. It was about what it meant to be a girl right now and the ways that some of us had these opportunities and some of us didn't, and how class and race and experience played into all of these things. And I think that was what sort of set me ticking on this path. And then when I graduated college and after the whole Ms. thing, I worked at Esquire for several years. And when I was interviewed for the job, and this is something, you know, I wrote this before all the Me Too thing started happening. I wrote the book was already going to press then. And I had to go back and add something about that. But I understand really viscerally how hard it is for women to speak out, even, you know, when we think like, why would you not say anything about that? Because I had this experience when I interviewed for Esquire that, well, far less extreme, even writing about it 30 years later, even though the guy in question is dead, because he was an older guy and, you know, he died of old age. He didn't die in any tragic way. I still kind of hesitated over the keyboard thinking, do I really want to say this? And it was just that, you know, that when I was interviewed, they said there was the guy that I worked for had a penchant for rubbing up against young female staffers with an erection. And could I handle that?
You know, you hear stories like this and you want to believe they're not true, but it totally happens. And I'm sorry you had to go through that.
And it was not like, and we're trying to do something about it.
This was something like, this guy just did?
Yeah, apparently he never did it to me, but you know, because I stayed very far away, but
naturally.
But
I probably would too if I heard this guy was around.
Right, but it was known, and the idea was not that, you know, we're going to do something about that. It was, you have to know how to deal with this if you're going to work here. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, I said, yeah, of course I can handle it, you know, because, you know, I wanted the job. I was at that time, I was like eating breakfast cereal for dinner. I desperately needed a job.
That's what's so messed up about that situation, right? is that you felt obligated to just tolerate it because you needed work.
Right. And so,
that was how the game worked.
Figure out how to deal with it. And I think there was a way that you know, I worked at a men's magazine for 3 years. But I think that there was a way that I was drawn to writing about women, and there was a way that it was also an opportunity because people weren't doing it because it was a male-dominated industry in mainstream, in non-women's magazines publications. And I also feel like I was pushed a little bit. I think that I didn't want to deal with that kind of thing. I didn't want to deal with sexual harassment. I didn't want to deal with what I was seeing was sort of lesser treatment of women in the industry. There was a lot that I think I just either felt would be corrosive to me or that I couldn't actually deal with, or I don't know. But I just thought, okay, if I do this, then I have my own little territory and nobody's going to mess with me in that way. And yes, I will be marginalized, but at least I will also be the go-to person on this. So I don't know that I thought about it that, you know, clearly when I was 22 years old, but I think that was partly what was going on in my head. So it was a draw, but it was also a bit of a dodge to start my career and go on the path of writing about women and girls.
I can't figure out what lies beneath the resistance to women having an equal place in the workplace. I'm younger than a lot of people participating.
If you say you're younger than me again, I'm going to hang up.
I'm saying, okay, would inexperienced be better?
Yeah.
I'm more inexperienced.
No, yeah.
Let's take a quick break and talk about the people who made this episode possible. I'm talking about Audible. I love this service. I use it all the time. I was so happy to hear they wanted to support Spellbound. Audiobooks are a great way to become a better you because I don't know about you guys, but I only have so much stamina for reading. And so popping an audiobook in my headphones while I'm doing some dishes or listening to it in the car is a great way to read a book. For Spellbound listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook and a free 30-day trial. All you got to do is go to audible.com/spellbound. Or text Spellbound to 500-500. Browse their unmatched selection of audio content, download a title for free, and start listening. It's literally that easy. Whether you want to feel healthier or get motivated or learn something new, Audible has an audiobook for that. I've been listening to the book we're talking about today, Peggy's Don't Call Me Princess, and I love how whenever I log in, no matter what device I'm on, Audible remembers where I left off in the book so I don't miss a thing. Audible members get a credit every month, good for any audiobook regardless of price, and unused credits roll over to the next month every time. Don't like your audiobook? You can exchange it. No questions asked. Get your free audiobook with a 30-day free trial at audible.com/spellbound or text spellbound to 500-500. That's audible.com/spellbound or text spellbound to 500-500. Okay, Peggy, I believe where we left off, we were talking about women in the workplace and men forcing women to put up with inappropriate behavior in order to get jobs. What I was trying to say earlier is that I don't understand what makes men treat women this way, and maybe that's just an age thing. I hope that's all it is. Maybe there's just a generation that needs to die off still, and then everything will be fine. But I don't understand this, and whenever I hear it, it makes me feel embarrassed to be a man because I find this behavior repulsive.
Well, Yeah, although, you know, it's not, that's not just an age issue, because there's a piece in there where, so the book has, you know, the different sections, and there's the section that you've been referring to, which is sort of profiles and reported pieces. And then there's pieces on breast cancer, because I've been dealing with that for more than 20 years, and pieces on parent motherhood, and in one of the, and pieces on girls, and in one of the pieces I'm talking about the first time Hillary Clinton ran for president, and the sort of regardless of how you felt about her qualifications or her politics or her, how compromised she was or whatever, the nature of the attacks were so despicably misogynist so often. And I talk about walking by a misogynist poster in Berkeley, about a Hillary Clinton poster, with my daughter, who was 4 at the time, and trying to explaining that. You had the flower and the nature. Try explaining the misogynist poster to your daughter.
That's,
you know,
a little heavier.
And right. It got me thinking a lot about how we raise girls and how we do and don't talk to them about women in power. And I think that that part of the Me Too or conversation has really cracked this open, because there was a way that I felt, you know, looking at that poster, I thought, so do we tell them, you know, that there are more opportunities for women than there ever were, or do we tell them about the hell that's going to rain down on them if they try to take those opportunities? And I talk about that it's not age dependent, that when they did a study of millennials, or survey of millennials, on how they felt about male and female bosses, and millennial men were actually as conservative or more conservative, in the sense that they would prefer to work for a guy, and the women too. So I don't know that all of these issues will just go away because old people will, you know, stop being in the workplace, but I think that the kind of discussion that has been cracked open this year, which I've just been watching with it's just been stunning, you know, to watch things being discussed in this huge public way. I think that that's where the change can occur, and where we can move forward. And honestly, I don't know if we'd be having this discussion if Hillary Clinton were elected. I think that part of the reason we're having it is that, you know, that Trump infuriated women, and it just started this whole thing rolling.
You touched on something a second ago when you were talking about how there's two things I actually want to touch on. The first thing is that you said you don't think these problems are going to disappear just with older people dying and leaving the workplace, yeah, and this new generation coming in. And that's kind of in line with an idea that we talked about in our episode from last week. We talked to an evolutionary biologist about, not about sex, but about race. And he was talking about how there's actually a gene that you could call racist that is in people. And it's a controversial part of the discussion that's unfolding now. But he says that there's like ants, that there's colonies of ants that will enslave other colonies of ants because they don't have the moral understanding that humans do. And therefore it's humans' it's the responsibility of people to put an end to this kind of inequality, because we do have that higher knowledge and we're not just bacteria swimming around in a bowl. We have feelings and things like that. And I couldn't help but feel like somehow that relates to what you're saying, because maybe not from an evolutionary standpoint, but maybe culturally, because there was a point in time in a tribal sense when we each relied on our differences in order to have a successful tribe. And and now technology and society has brought us to a place where a lot of our differences are kind of being neutralized because you know, computers do a lot for us and technology does a lot for us. And now people get to have a choice of what they want to do with their lives for the very first time in the history of the world. And so it's interesting, because that's kind of what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think there's a number of stories in the book that sort of speak to that. There's a piece on Elizabeth Blackburn, who is now won a Nobel Prize, but she's a biologist. It's a profile of her that's exploring the idea of why there aren't more women in higher level academic science. And for years, the presumption was that the pipeline would take care of it. And once we got more women in, you know, in the undergraduate level and in high school and all, that naturally over time, it would even out with just on its own. And that did not happen. They started saying, you know, the pipeline was leaky. Women would just leak right out of it. So it was discussing the subtleties of what, well, sometimes it's not subtleties, sometimes it's pretty darned overt, but the combination of subtle and overt discrimination that was tacitly pushing women out of those positions as they moved into the upper echelons, and then talking about this sort of one woman's life and how she did or didn't fight back against that or push back against that in her own career. So that was really interesting. And there was a study in that, a survey, I say in that piece, or study, I guess, where a professor sent applications out to thousands of, I forget what the job was for, if it was in business or if it was in science, but she sent out resumes. And the only difference in the resume, it was for an academic position. The only difference in the resume was male name or a female name. And the percentage of people who said they would hire the male candidate was just vastly higher than those who would hire the female candidate, even though the resumes were identical. And I had noticed that just last summer, there was a similar survey that went out about that was having to do with both gender and age. So the people who came out on the bottom, even with identical resumes, were older women. Back to that age thing again, I guess, Julian. So it's just interesting.
Hey, that was
to see
this time.
It's interesting to see how those issues sort of continue to circle back. And I think one of the really cool things for me about putting this collection together was that I got to sort of look at, you know, one in doing your career, you know, you just move forward, right? You just do what you do. You do the next thing, especially if you're a creative person. You know, you write your article, you do your podcast, you write your book, you do whatever you do. And you don't tend to look back and say, gee, what are the through lines of my work? What have I done? What does it mean to, you know, look at something I did 20 years ago or something? And how does it remain relevant today? And it was really interesting to see how, and sometimes a little discouraging, to see how relevant things that I'd written a while, you know, some years ago remained, and how the issues were at this very moment just coming back around in really sharp relief. So it was actually useful for me in thinking about, you know, my life now, what I want to write now, what the activism today means in the culture, all these issues that we're bringing up now, to see how I was writing about them, you know, back then, was kind of fascinating. And I hope will be fascinating for other people as well.
Yeah, well, it's certainly fascinating for me. And what's interesting about what you just said is that it kind of implies that there is an ideology that is unconsciously being operated upon with, you know, like you said, there was like two resumes that were identical and older women were unfavorable in that scenario.
Yeah.
So this is old mentality that has to change.
Right. I feel like, you know, watching it over time and being able to stand back and take the long view, you see that, you know, it's not a static thing, but it's kind of a spiral, and change happens, but then other change doesn't. And, you know, like I think, okay, when I was a little girl, my mom wouldn't have been able to have a credit card in her own name, you know, because she was a housewife.
Wow.
Right? That was a thing. You can't even imagine that. I mean,
maybe that's a good thing. She wouldn't be able to go into debt.
Well, yeah, maybe. Sometimes I just think about stuff like that. Or you know, we just forget really how backwards certain things were, or that, you know, marital rape wasn't recognized until, like, oh, I'm going to get this wrong, but it was like around 1990. You know, it was very recently that marital rape became a crime. So there's you know, there's some major changes that we take for granted. And then there are other things that either don't change or change a little bit and backslide, or, you know, the issues of how we, with sexual assault, of, you know, how we're defining it, what it means, what sexual harassment is, you know, that this is not flirting, that you're, you know, somebody, that rape is not somebody jumping out at you from a dark alley, you know, all of that is something that we're really embroiled in discussing and thinking about change right now. That seems to be the task of this moment. And 10, 20 years from now, we'll think, okay, we've totally forgotten how we used to look at that stuff, but look at what's going on now. You know, I mean, I just think there's sort of ongoing things that we change. And then, you know, maybe it's like owning a house where you're, you know, you fix the roof and then you suddenly realize the floor needs fixing. And then you realize that the bedroom needs painting and you just go on and on and on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've wondered too, if there's a point where these issues will cease to exist or if it'll just continue to change and evolve. I'd like to think that we're heading towards some ultimate utopia, but who knows?
Well, I mean, I think that's the, you know, there's that goal. But I mean, even if you think about like ideas about democracy, I mean, all ideas just keep evolving and changing. And that's not, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. And we try to move towards a more equitable, just society. And we change, you know, I almost feel like I see it in parenting. And I remember when I had my daughter that I thought, okay, there are like three things that I would like to change from my own upbringing so that I don't, you know, subject her to those things. And there'll be like seven more things that I'll do that I didn't even know I was doing that she's going to hate me for when she grows up, right? That you got to put money in the therapy fund over. But at least I can change those three things. And then when she grows up maybe and has children, she can change three different things. And, you know, we can make it a little better, but there's always going to be the thing that you didn't think to change.
We all have blind spots.
Yeah.
Wow, we just covered a lot of ground there. There was a second thing that I wanted to cover from about 15 minutes ago. You said something a few minutes ago about whether you should teach your daughter about the oppression of women from the past and encourage her to take the opportunities that are there, or educate her on the hell that will come down on her if she chooses to take those opportunities. Do you think that hell will come down on women who try to take the opportunities that are presenting themselves?
Sometimes. Not always, but at that time
what do you think determines that?
Well, I was writing about what, you know, Clinton as this lightning rod for the way that we feel about women in power. And in part, you know, again, I'm not saying that people can have issues with her politics or whatever, but when the attacks take this misogynist edge, like I think I was looking at things like the Hillary Nutcracker and the, you know, obviously the chanting the make me a sandwich or iron my shirt or whatever it was, and all these different things. I just kind of did put a list of them in the article. And then I was talking about some, there had just been a case in Austin, Texas, which one thinks of as a liberal stronghold, in the fire department, where they hired a woman firefighter, and the guys in her house were doing horrible, you know, they were smearing her locker with excrement and they were doing all this stuff. And I was thinking, gee, my daughter wanted, you know, she's 4 years old. She wants to be a firefighter when she grows up. You know, like, it's not like I'm going to tell my 4-year-old, no, somebody's going to smear excrement, you know, but it's and what we're seeing now in terms of sexual harassment and sexual assault of women in the workplace, it's really hard to, or even in college, there was just a Tulane University just put out a report that 4 out of 10 students say that they have been raped on that college campus. And, you know, would you send your daughter to some place where 4 out of 10 students were shot in a drive-by? You know, you would go, no, I think that's a little unsafe.
Yeah. You know, I guess what I feel is that we're heading into a landscape where women are going to get an equal chance. And I say that just because, you know, if you look at Hollywood, for example, like Wonder Woman was a huge success, which is amazing. I love Dana Carvey's stand-up special on Netflix, Straight White Male 60. That title alone
I haven't seen it.
Oh, you've got to watch it. You will love it. He's a genius.
Yeah, you know, I know what you're saying, and I think you're right. And of course, and I think that all of this is going to, again, you know, result in some moving forward. And I think that the movie, the stuff in Hollywood, you know, there have been some people who have just been doing fantastic work on pushing greater representation in Hollywood, like Gina Davis. She's been amazing. Right. So, yeah, I mean, I'm not telling my daughter you can't do it because if you do this, you're going to be attacked or assaulted or whatever. And I do worry that girls are afraid. I hear a lot of high school girls who fear going to college now because of the discussions around assault. And that makes me very sad and upset. However, I think we also have to help girls and I have a whole other thing about boys, but I think we have to help girls be resilient. And one of the things that I think about a lot is that in the African-American community, parents talk to their kids about structural barriers and racism so that when they, I worry that with girls in general of all ethnicities, that if we don't talk to them about structural barriers and the need to push and fight and be strong and resilient in the face of structural barriers, that when if we tell them you can do anything and then they can't because they were sexually harassed or they can't because of discrimination or something, they don't look at it from a structural perspective. They just think they personally failed.
Right.
And so I do think that we have to educate our girls to be able to critique the media. I think we need to educate girls to understand gender dynamics in personal relationships and in sexuality. I think that we need to talk to girls about discrimination in the workplace and what we need to actively stand up for and against so that they are not just thinking as individuals, but that they're thinking about how they can affect and change the culture and where limits need to be pushed and how maybe they can participate in pushing them.
Yeah, it sounds like, it's our job as parents to educate our kids on the past and the future.
Yeah. So, I mean, I just had a really interesting conversation with my daughter who's in high school now, we have a lot of tussles around makeup and I do, you know, that is one of the things that I write essays I write about in the book is about girls in clothing and girls in makeup and girls in sexiness and girls in self-objectification. And that doesn't mean that I don't have my own battles about it with my own daughter, you know? And so we talk a lot about makeup, and she was talking about a new line by the cosmetic company Tarte, T-A-R-T-E, that I guess it's a line of foundations, or I don't know what it is, some kind of thing like that, powder foundation. And she was talking about the value of the internet was that when they came out with this foundation line and it had mostly foundations that would look good on Caucasians, which my daughter is not, that teenage girls went ballistic and, you know, started a campaign and made them, you know, at least say, oops, that was a mistake.
I love that.
Yeah, and that's kind of great. I mean, there's part of me that's like, wish it wasn't on makeup because that's complicated, but it's really interesting that girls recognized that was an unjust thing and it was important to them, and it was important that the product that they want to buy fall in line with their beliefs. And okay, you know, that's really interesting. And so we sort of talked about the complexity of all of that. And I felt like that was the kind of conversation that I love having with her now, where she can, you know, she's less literal because she's getting older, and she can critique the culture that she's in, even if she chooses to participate in it in ways that don't always make me comfortable. And I feel like having the kinds of conversations with her that I write about, you know, and kind of leave myself twisting in the wind about in Don't Call Me Princess, really did set up the scaffolding so that we can have these conversations now.
There's a part in Don't Call Me Princess where you say that brands like the Spice Girls, which were clearly aiming to align themselves with the feminist movement, ultimately hurt the progress that was being made. And this was fascinating to me when I read it, not only because I would love to forget the Spice Girls, but...
I know.
Do you think that... Do you think that the conversation that's been, that is taking place now has changed? And if so, how?
Well, I think there's always that tension between commercialism and corporate kind of co-opting of a political message and the message itself. So with Spice Girls, you know, that started as that whole, you know, girl power thing began as a very subversive idea with girls who would, you know, write slut across their bellies and make their little zines that they, you know, when zines were big, and wear their combat boots and plaid shirts and all of that, and shave their heads. And it was a very kind of radical, aggressive movement. And then Spice Girls came along and turned girl power into sort of shopping and liking your friends, and, you know, took all the grr out of it, basically. And it became something really different. I mean, you don't see, like, bicurious Spice or hugely overweight Spice or, you know, anything like that. You know, there's a very, very narrow idea of what you are supposed to be as Spice Girl. And suddenly girl power became a logo on a t-shirt and a fashion statement and the power to buy, you know, this shirt versus that shirt. And it really became a commercial, ultimately exactly the opposite of what it was. It was a call to not critique rather than to critique. So that, I mean, you know, you saw that like in the 70s with the old, I don't know if you well, again,
watch it.
Age difference. Yeah. But yep, I just remember this again from when I was a kid I just have a piece in the New York Times book review on feminist vibrator stores, books on feminist vibrator stores, where I talk about this very issue of the tension between commercial culture and feminist ideas. And you saw it back in the old days with the Virginia Slims commercials. I don't know if you remember.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so there was, you know, you've come a long way, baby, to get where you've got to today. You've got your own cigarette now, baby. You've come a long, long way. You know, like that was the liberation, was that you had your own cigarette, Virginia Slims. So there's always, and even the, you know, feminist pillow in Urban Outfitters. I don't know, you know, is that a statement of identity? Is that a statement of your politics? Or is that just like the fashion statement of the moment and will blow over next year? I don't know. So there's always those tensions. And there's always kind of a diluting of political ideas when they become corporate identities. You know, the various, you know, femvertising. I have an essay in there on femvertising and the ways that messages about female empowerment get tucked into advertising in order to appeal to women, but in a kind of emotional way rather than an actual like political or activist way. And the ultimate one, which I talk about, I wrote introductions to all the pieces to sort of, you know, bring them up to date. And just as I was publishing, as I was turning the book in, there was an ad on International Women's Day by some eye drop company for what they called eyepowerment, where they just played Betty Davis Eyes, that song, that pop song, over images, black and white images of inspirational women. And then the idea was that that would make you buy eye drops. And I thought, that is like, it has jumped the shark, man.
It's kind of manipulative.
That is crazy. Like, what does empowerment mean if that's what it is, right?
Yeah,
it
means the problem, like, with that is, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
It's okay. I was going
to
say, it just makes you feel like, ooh, I feel that, you know, a sense of empowerment because I've been manipulated by photos and music.
Yeah, but it's not doing anything.
It's doing less than nothing. So there's always that. And that, yeah, I think, I mean, that essay, I when I pulled that up, I thought, wow, that's something that we're really, that has gotten even bigger than since I wrote about it a few years ago.
You quote Caitlin Moran in the book saying something along the lines of, poor Rihanna, she has all the power and riches in the world, but in every video she makes, she can only wear panties.
Right.
Right. I think there's a lot of truth in that.
Well, no, Rihanna is properly powerful when she can wear a nice cardi. Yeah.
Yeah, she'll be powerful when she can wear a cardigan.
Right.
I loved that. I think there's truth in that.
Yeah.
And it's sad because Rihanna is genuinely talented.
She is.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And I mean, what do you think needs to happen in order to flip this paradigm on its head?
Well, I think what's really interesting is that when I was young, self-objectification was something that we pushed back against as being an oppressive thing. And for girls today, what's really complicated is that it's sold to them as a form of self-empowerment. And so...
maybe through social media?
Well, and through these pop stars, through Kim Kardashian, through, you know, who's, you know, I guess pop star is the wrong word for her. I don't know what you call her, but through Rihanna, through even Beyonce, where you have somebody who is, I love Beyonce, you know, she's a queen, I worship her, but I sometimes wonder if she could say the things she says if she didn't look the way she looks.
Right.
And that was such a beautiful articulation of the dilemma and the ways.
Well, maybe it's a natural step in the process.
Could be, and it could be, you know, and I think with that, and one of, you know, and what I explore even more deeply is how disconnected that sexy image is from girls' understanding and enjoyment and feelings about their own actual sexuality, that, you know, that this supposed confidence that this clothing is giving them comes off when they take the clothing off. And so what really is, are they saying and doing then? And so, you know, I think it's really important with girls not to shame them around clothing and not to say, you know, that's distracting the boys, or you look like a prostitute, or, you know, whatever people, whatever it is that comes up in your head when you see your 13-year-old, you know, wearing whatever she just walked out of the room with. But to try to, in an ongoing way and starting well before she's going to put that outfit on, talk to her about, in an age-appropriate way, about self-objectification. And, you know, I've talked to my daughter a lot about the bait-and-switch nature of it. I've talked to her a lot about all the studies we know on self-objectification and how it's linked to depression and anxiety and eating disorders and self-cutting and even, you know, cognitive issues, like not being able to perform as well in school, all of these things. So if that's the truth, then where is the power in that? Where is the power in doing that? What are you being sold exactly? So I think the more we can make girls aware and put the onus not on an individual girl for, you know, dressing a particular way, but on a culture that's telling her to and calling that empowerment when it most clearly is not, is, you know, the better for young women.
I agree. This is all such a delicate dance because there are certain things that were handed to us through evolution and also just through running civilization successfully for as long as we've been doing it. There's certain things that just work. Like marriage is a thing that works because people don't want to be lonely, and, you know, people make good teams. When your differences can be reconciled in a cooperative way, it can be a healthy thing. And I think maybe we run the risk of... you know, I think we've just got to be careful in these conversations of as we move forward, that we try to really get to the root of our own logic that we're operating on, and that we don't throw anything good out in the process, and that we don't buy anything bad at the same time.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think a lot of times something like catches on or becomes a phenomenon in terms of corporate or commercial culture because it taps into something developmental or something about us, and then exploits that. So I talk, one of the articles in the book is the article that inspired my book, Cinderella Ate My Daughter. And it, you know, it's what's wrong with princesses. And I wrote it, when my daughter was in preschool and suddenly came home, able to recite all the names and gown colors of the Disney princesses. And I was, you know, sort of like, what's a Disney princess? I've never heard of that, because they didn't exist until 2001. And this was 2004, 2005. So before that, there was obviously, you know, the characters, but they were in their movies and they weren't called princesses. That's a new thing.
Right. So, well, they weren't there. They weren't this huge thing that they are now.
No, they weren't a phenomenon. They weren't. The thing that changed was that they were pulled out from their movies and for the first time in the history of the Disney Corporation marketed separately. From the release of a film. They used to just only, you could only get merchandise related to a character when they had a film out. So, you know, every 7 years they would put out Cinderella or Sleeping Beauty, and that was when you could get the merchandise. So they pulled them out, they marketed them all together, and that was what created this phenomenon. And my favorite thing about that is that there were forces in the company, the more traditional forces, that were against doing that because they said you can't mix mythologies. So you can't have like Belle and Cinderella and Snow White on the same product because the world would implode, or I don't know what they thought would happen. So if you look at the Disney princess products, you'll find that they're all the girls, the women on them are looking in slightly different directions because they're not supposed to know the other ones are there. So that was how they dealt with that. I know, you'll totally
very
go
clever,
nuts
Disney.
Now. Right? You'll like look at it and go, oh my God, oh my God. But anyway, that's a side point. In looking at it, you know, that moment that Disney princess, you know, now we think of it as a phase, which it didn't used to be. But the moment that hits is the moment when children are really rigid in their ideas about gender. And they believe that your gender will change if I was wearing a dress and I walked out of the room and I put on a suit and a tie, they would look at me and think, I'm a man now. And so they're very unclear about what gender really means, and they think you can change. I mean, well, you can, but, you know. So they tend to, at that age, gravitate towards whatever the culture offers them that is the most extreme and stereotypical representation of their gender. So when I was little, it was like baby dolls and buggies, right? And mm-hmm. now it's Disney princesses and, you know, mani-pedi birthday parties for three-year-olds. So there's a way that there was a developmental moment that is natural, and that Disney tapped into that and then exploited the hell out of it. And that's where we start to get into trouble.
Yeah, it's the exploitation that's the problem. And these companies are smart. They know the trends.
Oh, they're very smart. And that it really ghettoizes children. And it also is the moment, you know, what I realize now, again, having an older child, is it's the first moment that your daughter really comes up against, or you as a parent come up against, the commercial culture and what it wants to sell your daughter. And people will say, you know, it's so hard to say no, and her friends are doing it, and I don't want her to be left out, whatever. And I'll tell you, if you can't do it when your daughter is three, good luck doing it when she's 15.
Oh yeah. My wife and I believe that. Our kids have only seen, I think, one Disney movie. No, they've seen two now. They've seen Finding Nemo and The Jungle Book.
Yeah. And Mulan is fantastic.
That's a good one.
And Mulan 2 is even better, honestly. But I always say, you know, I have stuff on my website that's not very well organized of other things that, you know, that small children, that you can do with little girls that are alternatives to Disney princesses. But my biggest advice, if you want to be watching something, is to watch the Miyazaki movies, to watch My Neighbor Totoro, which, as it happens, distributed in this country by Disney. But they're, you know, the Japanese movies, My Neighbor Totoro, Kiki's Delivery Service, Nausicaa. I mean, those are brilliant. And
yeah, everything Japanese is better than what we have.
Yeah. But we watched those a gajillion, the way that other little girls watch Disney princess movies, my daughter watched those, and I had no problem with that. She spent like 2 years wearing this little black dress when she was 3 and 4. And how she had this little broom, and she was trying to be Kiki, and she would jump off our front step trying to fly on her broom. And I would say, just try it one more time. I know you can do it. Because it amused me so much.
I love that. Well, I love this conversation. We've covered a lot of really important stuff. And, you know, I think it's the whole point of this podcast is creating open-minded conversation about things. And I think I personally wonder if we're going to come to a point, and you know, I can't say because I don't know and I'm not qualified to say, but I wonder, you know, with all of these public conversations that are happening with feminism and Black Lives Matter and you know, there's 100 of these public conversations that are finally coming to center stage, and we're finally wrestling with all these conversations, and they need to be there. We need to be discussing these things, but I personally wonder if we're gonna reach a point where once everybody's on board with these ideas, what's the next goal after that? Is it to just perpetuate the idea of we are all one? We are all the same thing and we all matter, because it does seem like at the rate we're going, we're achieving progress, and it's amazing progress that we're achieving. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder if we're going to reach a point where we have to change the tune of our song to where we adopt a more unifying message.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, I think we're seeing the same thing that we saw before both of us, well, before you were born and when I was very, very, very little, you know, of the civil rights movement and the women's movement that kind of rose in tandem. And we're seeing a version of that again with Black Lives Matter and Me Too.
Right.
They get more clever names now because we're a more brandy kind of culture. And I think, I don't know in terms of what you say, but we certainly have a long way to go.
Absolutely, yeah.
But I do think that the ball that I keep my eye on is opportunity, education, reproductive mm-hmm. rights, mm-hmm. These issues that we need to have parity and equity and equality and the personal realm of the home and the bedroom. Boardroom and bedroom, you know, and parenting and all of these ways that we can not only allow, you know, women to have more opportunity out in the world and such, but also men more opportunity in the home and more expectation in the home, and where we're more about, I guess, what individuals having the broadest range of possible choices and opportunities to do what they can and want to do with their lives that do not have blocks based on their race, their gender, their sexual orientation, whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, old ideas need to be challenged. New ideas mm-hmm. need to be supported and have and be welcomed with open arms. And we all need to be striving towards a future where we are all in the same boat.
You go, Julian.
I don't know. It's a great idea, right? I think that's what we all want.
Sure. It's just not always, it sounds good, but it's not always so easy. You know, one of the things that in Schoolgirls, my first book that I talk about, is a teacher who was trying to create more equality in her sixth grade class because, you know, there's a tendency for boys to talk more and to get called on more by teachers and that sort of thing. And so she would hold her attendance roster and call on boys and girls equally. And after about a few days of it, she said the boys got really, really angry. And they said that she was playing favorites and calling on the girls way too much and that it wasn't fair. And they were really mad. And she said it was interesting because she knew that that wasn't true. She knew what she had done was actually even the playing field because she was
right,
keeping track. And she said at that moment, she realized that, you know, sometimes for boys, equality feels like a loss.
Yeah, I think a lot of men feel that way. I don't personally feel that way.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, that when we talk about, you know, this idea of equality and all the things that we just said that sound, of course, reasonable in theory, that they can feel threatening, particularly to guys who don't have, well, I think actually also to guys who have power, but especially, and I think that this is what we see in kind of Trump America, men who feel disempowered and then feel angry when women or people of different ethnicities than them say that they're part of the problem or they're, they want a kind of equality that they don't have, then they feel threatened, disempowered, and discriminated against themselves, whether that is true or not true, but
right. And that cannot happen. It cannot happen. It's got to stop.
Part, yeah. And that's, I think, one thing that, you know, when we're talking about gender, I really don't think of it. And I think more and more others aren't thinking of it as something that is like women against men. But I think, you know, as we're all part of this system, that men have a huge role to play in creating more equality and more ability to, you know, be the person you want to be that will be better for men as well as women. But they have a huge role to play with other men. And that's one place I think that they can play it.
I agree. Whether if you're in any place of power, whether it's because of your race or your gender or whatever the reason is, These people have a tremendous amount of responsibility in light of these conversations to be okay with the playing fields becoming more equal because, you know, if we are all the same, if we are all one, if we are all in the same boat, then the only way we're going to get that we're going to have a harmonious society is by being happy that more people are getting chances and that things are becoming more fair. And so if people in places of power are going to have to be cool with this.
Yeah. And it's difficult. And even not, I mean, I am now talking to a lot of boys because I'm writing a book on boys and young men. And
don't call me Prince.
Yeah, no. Boys and sex, probably. And talking to them about what it means to, you know, how you stand up to other guys when they do something that you know is objectionable, but you feel if you stand up, you're going to lose status and be, you know, possibly mocked. That's really tough. Or what happens, you know, it's really easy to call out these people who are, you know, sexual predators, but what if you find out that your friend that you've had since that, you know, what if you're 21 years old and you find out that one of your friends that you've had since high school raped another one of your friends? What is your responsibility with that boy? Do you stay friends? Do you drop him? Do you try to stay friends and help him make change if that's possible? You know, like what is your role in all of this? And that's a whole area I think that we have not been talking about with guys. We've been just sort of like, you know, you need to cede power, you need to stand up. And that's one thing that I'm hoping with the next book to really be able to add some nuance to.
I love that. It's also important and valuable for the conversation. And I appreciate you, Peggy, making time for this conversation.
It was great fun. Thank you.
Yeah, your new book, Don't Call Me Princess, is out February 27th. Be sure to check it out, everybody. And Peggy, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Julian.
Have a great day.
You too.
I want to hear your thoughts on this conversation. Drop me a line in the comments section. You're not just dropping me a line when you do that, by the way. You're talking to literally everyone listening to the episode, and that's what this whole podcast is about, creating conversation. So don't click away before you share your thoughts. If you have something longer you want to send me, you can shoot me an email, hello@spellboundshow.com. Be sure to hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode. That way your phone will always stay up to date. And next week, we're talking to Dr. Richard Elliott Friedman again, back by popular demand. I can't believe you guys want to talk more about the Bible. Honestly, I was so worried to release the last episode because the Bible is such a polarizing topic, but I was so pleasantly surprised to see that people of all religious backgrounds were equally fascinated and participating in the conversation open-mindedly. And even Dr. Friedman noticed that after the episode was released. He was talking about how amicable the conversation in the comments was, and that's just something you don't see a whole lot of. And so what a cool thing. The Bible is a fascinating book no matter what you think about it, and so you don't want to miss the episode next week. The conversation Dr. Friedman and I have is one of the most fascinating conversations I've ever been a part of. I'm Julian Smith. This has been Spellbound. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did, and I look forward to seeing you guys next week. Take care.